It can only be Millennial. And now here is your host, Millennial Woes.
Hello and welcome back to Millennial X. I'm now here with Harrison H. Smith. Harrison, I think I contacted you a year ago, just shortly after or maybe during last Millennial, to ask if you would be willing to appear, because I had a feeling, but it was too late then. So, yeah, thank you for agreeing to appear. Would you introduce yourself to the audience for anyone who isn't familiar with you?
Sure, absolutely. Yeah, it definitely was during Millennial because I was very confused. I was like, is he scheduling a year in advance? This guy's professional. So, yeah, I appreciate the invite. And I've been waiting all year to be here, and I've been enjoying the show so far. I'm Harrison H. Smith. I host American Journal on InfoWars. That's the morning show. I'm sort of the lead-in to Alex Jones. I've been doing that since 2021, actually. Exactly 4 years in a couple days. And yeah, I'm on X at Harrison H. Smith. And you can go to moonbase.show to find a show that I do on Rumble called Moonbase Live.
All right. And how would you describe, your own sort of politics, your own worldview?
How much time do we have?
2 hours.
Okay, great. That might be enough. I'm an American patriot. You know, I'm an American firster. I'm a Christian. I'm sort of a Christian nationalist, if you want to know the truth. I came from a libertarian school. I still would consider myself a libertarian, but in the sense that liberty is my highest goal. And I sort of gauge what I think we need to do around what will achieve liberty. So you could say libertarian, but, you know, that obviously has some connotations that I've sort of moved away from recently. The idea of smaller government, I think, is kind of a pipe dream at this point, and we need more realistic, actionable things to do in the future. So I'm a conservative, a Republican, and a libertarian, technically at my foundation. I'm not a party guy necessarily. So I'm a Republican in ideology.
What would you say are the shortcomings of libertarianism? You said that you could be described as that, but that's not quite accurate, because I think a lot of people are like this, that they were libertarians at one point, especially during the Ron Paul phase, the Tea Party and all that. But that's, 12 years ago now. What would you say you've learned that took you away from that?
I still love Ron Paul. He is still, you know, the godfather of sort of whatever this movement is. But I'd say the individualism is a poison pill. And I think libertarianism is kind of a trick a lot of the times. It's just sort of an unfeasible – it's like a great ideal. If you were to set up my ideal society, it would be a libertarian one. It would be minimal government, people just behaving themselves. But you have to have a moral and upright and intelligent populace to pull that off. And frankly, we've lost that in the recent past. So I guess I've gotten away from that. You know, I wouldn't say I'm more conservative, because I think we've lost everything that we would want to conserve. So I don't know if there's a definition out there. But in terms of libertarianism, I think it's the focus on the individualism that is a great crippling – has a great crippling effect on achieving anything, and is not the way that successful movements operate. I think we need some form of collectivism. And I also think that minimizing the government is not the priority for me right now. I care less about how much the government spends and how much it does than I do what it spends its money on and how it conducts itself. So, and also, you know, just the modern world is such that libertarianism has shortcomings that we don't have answers for. You know, things like content on the internet that has to be monitored and taken care of, like, you know, child abuse material, stuff like that. So, yeah, it's things like that that I think, you know, I'm not scared of a strong, powerful federal government. I want a federal government that serves us, serves the American people, serves our ideals. It doesn't necessarily have to be small to do that. It maybe should be big to contend with, I don't want to say enemies, but opponents like China and you know, Russia and these things. You need a big centralized government. It just has to be controlled and actually beneficial for the American people, which it's not right now.
Yeah, yeah. At this point, it seems like the American government is quite detached from the American people and mostly sees them as a huge tax cow, but it doesn't seem to have much respect for them. Of course, it's the same everywhere. It's the same in Britain, in many countries. But with America, I think there was an assumption of, personal liberty, which is often revealed to be illusory. I mean, if you do something that the state doesn't like, it will. I mean, I don't need to name specific incidents, but it will get you under control. There's that. And then also that I think there was an assumption that the American government would be quite patriotic. And I think that has also fallen away, partly because of globalism, partly because of other things, dual loyalty and so on. That I'm not sure you would want to go into.
Yeah, we can go into that.
Yeah. And so I think American people today, speaking as an outsider, are realizing that the government isn't on their side to the degree that they thought it was.
Yes. Yeah, very, 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 very much so. You know, the government not only doesn't benefit America, it seems actively antagonistic towards Americans at this point. And it's all just a psyop, and I think people are waking up from that. And I also think just in terms of like my understanding of what liberty is, I think has kind of changed. And I think the classic libertarian thing is to go out and live in a cabin in the woods, which I would say is not liberty in the traditional sense. It's a form of freedom, but it's also like, you're free to freeze and die. You're free to eat the wrong berries and, you know, bleed internally. You're free to be eaten by a bear. I don't want to be free in the woods by myself. I want a civilization that upholds my freedom. And if you go back to like the basics of the definition of liberty, like where it came from, you know, it was the liberty of Rome, meant you were under the protection of Rome. It meant that nobody could mess with you no matter where you were. You didn't have to be in Rome. You were under the protection of Rome. Anywhere you went, people knew this guy's got an entire nation behind him and we better not mess with him. That's what I want. I want the freedom to, you know, travel around my country, but also around the world and know that I'm a part of a larger collective that has my back. Like that's very intrinsic and human and is different than what a lot of people mean by liberty, which they mean just, like I said, go off in the woods and be alone or something. I don't want that. I want a big civilization. So I think, you know, liberty to me is freedom plus civilization. You have to have both of these things. And I think I hope people are recognizing that as well. I think people are just sort of waking up from a delusion that we've been in collectively for a long time and realizing that you can't trust the media, you can't trust the government, they're not working for you, they're actively working against you, they're controlled by outside interests. Like, I don't know how they kept these problems hidden for so long. Maybe they just grew to such a size that they couldn't be ignored anymore. Maybe that explains at least part of the waking up process. But I think Trump had a lot to do with it as well. Right, the libertarian position, sort of classically or arguably, is that the border should be open because these are, you know, arbitrarily laid governmental lines that you should be able to ignore. And I think that's ridiculous. I think it's pretty obvious it's ridiculous at this point. And so I think that may have been like one of the first breaks, and it's probably been the first break for a lot of people away from an obsession with small government. It's kind of like, well, the government is there specifically to, if you boil government down, like the purpose of it down to one thing, just get rid of everything that is not the core of it. The one core thing at the very center of it all is protecting the people on the inside of the country from the people on the outside of the country. And our government doesn't even do that. So it's a strange place to be in because we don't trust our government. Our government seems incapable of doing anything that benefits us, and yet we're still the most advanced and powerful and, you know, dedicated. And when we want to do something, America can absolutely do it. And so I think there's the major frustration now is with people going, why am I not benefiting from the strength of America? Why is America so powerful? How do we print trillions of dollars, and yet I'm working my ass off and barely scraping by? And I think that is a good thing to be righteously indignant about. I think we have not gotten our just desserts, and people are sort of pissed off at that. And I credit Trump to having a pretty big influence.
Well, the thing is that there must already have been an appetite for this kind of thing. Otherwise, Trump like in 2015, before he was, well, let's say, yeah, 2015, before he announced his candidacy, people must already have been thinking along these lines. Otherwise, it wouldn't have gained traction. You know, I think he must have detected something real, something that was already there. And then, of course, as you say, he definitely accelerated it in 2016 with the reaction to him, and then in 2020 again, and then now. Although now it seems to be lessening. But certainly I agree with you that the very existence of Trump doing what he's doing has just, it's caused what you might call the establishment, the regime, the deep state, the left. It's caused them to go nuts, which in turn illuminates that he was right in the first place.
Right.
Yeah, I really don't think we can underestimate the awakening that Trump has caused. And it wasn't Trump. It was their reaction to it. You know, it's like I was watching this YouTube video. It popped up. I was just like doing chores and YouTube videos were sort of playing and I was listening to him. And it was some sort of lefty dude. He was talking about Saturday Night Live. And I was listening because I like hearing about sort of behind the scenes stuff like that. But he brings up Trump becoming like getting into politics. And he's blaming Trump for SNL becoming terrible, Saturday Night Live becoming terrible. And it's like, how could Trump have any effect on Saturday Night Live? But it's the same thing that happens with the media saying Trump brought all of this hate to the nation. It's like Trump just existed. Trump just went out there and did his thing. What he said wasn't, you know, outrageous or anything. And then their reaction to it has ruined everything and has woken everybody up. So, you know, I think about like my dad, who was just very conservative all my life. Like I was raised just in a very conservative household. You know, big Bush guy. And we would get in arguments during like the Iraq war where I was watching Alex Jones and going, this is all a psyop. We, you know, this is a trick. It's the globalists. And he was going, you're falling into communism. Why don't you just move to Russia? You know, we were having that argument. And then Trump comes along and like, you know, at this point, my dad is farther down the rabbit hole than I am, right? He got into the Q stuff. He's not like a Q-tard type guy. But, you know, Q and the awakening like that. I remember after January 6th, my mom like texting with all of her mom friends being like, we better get on Signal. We don't, you know, we better get on some sort of encrypted chat because our government is crazy and is going to start coming after us. So it's like, especially in the boomer generation, the awakening that has come about because of Trump, but more because of the reaction to Trump has been like astounding to me. And yeah, it's, you know, the way I always characterize it is it's like their first plan A, was Hillary Clinton. It was luring us into the cage. You know, humanity is this tiger that they have to contend with. One thing I reject about like conspiracy theories and, you know, claims about globalists or Jews or whoever you want to call it is they're not all powerful. Not everything is a psyop. Not absolutely everything is false. They have to contend with human beings. They have to contend with will. They have to contend with reality. And so people, you know, have this perspective that either everything is controlled or nothing is. I totally lost my train of thought right there. I forgot why I was bringing that up. But it was a very poignant note I was going to make that I'm sure will come to me.
Well, you see, I was just looking through my meme folder for one that's just ideal for what you were saying just now about the boomer waking up. Because I had this meme and it was really funny. And it was the boomer dad saying to his son, be careful what you post on social media. Wild party photos could harm your career in the future. And then 10 years later, the boomer dad's holding his rifle and he's got his mask on and all this, and he's saying, I'm going to storm the Capitol.
Yes. When the boomer began to hate.
That's awesome.
Yeah. No, there really is something to that where it's like, you know, it goes from, like I was saying, you know, just like, shut up, Dad, you don't realize it till like, you know, 20 years later, you're going, all right, let's pump the brakes here, Dad. Let's, you know, let's really look into what this Q figure is and see if we can't, if riddles on the internet aren't the best place to get our information. Yeah, man, it's fascinating. And I hope people are handling it well. Cause one of the blessings of my life is that, you know, I actually had a best friend that was Lebanese in like sixth grade. We saw like 9/11 happen at the same time. And so we'd be watching these little newscasts, you know, before, you know, they're put together by CNN and everybody watched them in their homeroom in middle school. And my friend would be sitting there listening to the Arabic that they were saying and reading the subtitles and going, they're lying. That's not what he's saying right now. And going, you see the way Osama bin Laden is wearing a gold watch? People in Islam aren't allowed to wear gold watches. This video is fake. That's not Osama bin Laden. So, you know, from middle school, I was kind of, you know, red-pilled, had my mind blown, was open to this stuff, you know, found Alex Jones in middle school at some point. So, you know, this has been like 20 years for me. Now people are getting hit with the same amount of information in like 6 months. I hope they're handling it all right. I hope it's not driving too many people over the deep end.
Well, this is a thing. You know, for me, it was, you know, becoming red-pilled was a process that took about, well, more than 10 years, probably about 13 years, 13, 14. And yeah, but now, because there's so much online already, so there's almost... I think there must be sort of like a recruitment ground somewhere. I'm joking, obviously, for the feds. It's like there is a training process that is ready. It's just there, and you would never be able to remove it. I don't think anyone even constructed it. It's just there. So someone gets into it and then very quickly learns everything in close succession. And then you get the phenomenon of the person who ODs on the red pill. And is obsessed and doom porn and our countries are doomed and fucked and all that. And then the person who thinks that absolutely everything is a conspiracy. So it's like the zeal of the convert where, okay, I was tricked about X, Y, and Z. Therefore, I've also been tricked about everything else. Everything's a lie. So that's a phenomenon that's, I don't know if it's always existed. I don't think so. I think it's something, I definitely see it a lot over the last sort of 5 years.
Yeah, it's, you know, we're like, a lot of people are like beaten dogs, you know, it's like, if a dog's been beaten, you know, in its early life, you know, anytime you pick up a broom, it's going to go hide under the bed. It's like, we're like traumatized by how much we've been lied to. And we find it hard to trust people again. And, you know, I find it frustrating. That's funny. Somebody said it's called 4chan, the training ground. And that's exactly what I was thinking, because there's something very unique about 4chan in that you had to sort of have an iron resolve to even go there. Any normie that goes there immediately just closes the window, right? They see one or two images and they're just like, whoa, I don't know what this is. Click, you know, they exit. They can't. So it was in a way just by virtue of the outrageousness of the content there and the disturbing nature of some of the content there, anybody who was not hard of heart would avoid it. And so it was just a natural, almost like censorship thing, where if you weren't okay with these radical ideas, you just self-segregated and just removed yourself from that pool. And then something happened with 4chan. I mean, after, you know, Trump got elected, something, basically everything changed significantly, right? Reddit, and I mean, they realized how they'd messed up. Oh, that's what I was saying. I'm sorry to go back to my point before. Was that the plan A was Hillary Clinton. I genuinely think Trump was a shock to the world elite, and it was an interruption to their plan, a major one. And so plan A is sort of luring the tiger into the cage and hoping they don't notice. And Donald Trump is when the tiger's like about to step in the cage. I mean, Hillary Clinton would have been – she would have started war with Syria. I mean, she was talking about a no-fly zone over Syria, which would have gotten us in direct confrontation with Russia. They would have implemented all of the censorship stuff they eventually did. They would have done it quicker. That would have been like us going in the cage and the door slamming shut. Trump was us like putting a paw in the cage and looking up and going, hold on, is this a cage? Should I take a step back? And so then the globalists are presented with a question. Do they sort of back up and go, ooh, God, he almost found us out. Let's relax and chill and wait for the tiger to lower his defenses again before getting him? They chose the alternative route, which was to reach out and try to grab the tiger and try to shove us in, you know, as hard as they could. I think they were frustrated. They were like so close, because I really think they have a plan that sort of has an end. And I think the end is immortality for themselves. And in order to achieve that, they have to establish a one world government in which they are the unquestioned superiors and everybody else basically serves them in the hopes that they eventually be granted immortality. And they think they're on the cusp of that, and they're really working like overtime trying to get a system in place in which that type of technology can be revealed. Because obviously if you just reveal that there's anti-aging stuff that means you'll live forever, you know, barring some accident, or you can upload your consciousness to and that one's iffy anyway. But if you literally have, you know, life extension technology that can make somebody live and be healthy 200, 300 years old, you can't give that to everybody. If you give that to everybody, that's infinite growth. That's impossible. That will actually destroy us. So you have to have a very small number of people with access to this, and then they'll use it as a, you know, as a carrot to dangle over people to go, if you behave well enough, maybe you can join us up here. But they have to establish a system which people accept that and are okay with that. So I think that there's like actually an end to the globalist program. I think they think they're very close to it, and we're freaked out when Trump got elected, because that was the tiger pausing and looking around, and they chose to try to aggressively impose the control system, and that just woke people up even more. So now it's this race of the awakening versus the shutdown. And I don't know which one is going to come out on top, but I think they are sort of back in the satellite. I think they feel like they have sort of weathered most of the storm. I think that's why Trump has gotten elected and hasn't been killed yet. And I think, I think it's happening.
It's difficult to work out, though, because there were at least two attempts on Trump's life. During the campaign, definitely two, and so that implies that, well, I mean, unless it's that might just be lone wolves, or it might be some faction of the elite engineering that, authorizing that, in which case the elite has not wholly made peace with Trump. I think that some faction of the elite definitely has made peace with. They're sort of resigned to it. They've, okay, we're going to have to use them. We can't beat them, so we're going to have to join them, kind of thing. But it seems if that is the case, then, well, as I say, it's not total. I think they would have preferred to get Kamala in, but I don't know if they ever seriously thought that was going to happen. Biden, I guess they just realized, well, he is senile. We can't hide it anymore. So we're going to have to, yeah. And that seems to be what, I mean, that's just a summary off the top of my head. But that seems to be what happened there. Now, you said that that there is an end point to the globalist program. What would you say that is? Because this links, I mean, I'm sure you're very au fait with the experience that Europeans had with COVID, during COVID, that era. I think it was bad in America too, but my feeling is that it was a lot worse in Europe and Canada, everywhere but America. So you're no doubt you know how bad it got. During that period, a lot of people thought, well, this really is a sort of prototype for what they want for us, where it's an elite class of billionaires, and the rest of us are just meaningless. The rest of us are just peasants. And they don't need the society of capitalism, innovation, free enterprise, competition. They don't need that anymore. They've got a system for living that needs corporatocracy. It needs powerful corporations, but it doesn't need capitalism as such. And so the rest of us would be living basically under communism. And then, of course, the phrase "you'll own nothing and be happy" became a big deal. And I think that wasn't an official policy of the WEF, but I think it was something that was rattling around in their think tanks, and maybe a bit more honest than they would have intended to be. Well, what do you think about all of this? Do you think that is the end game for the globalists? And, you know, maybe Agenda 2030 comes into this.
Yeah, absolutely. No, it all has to do with that. COVID was definitely the prototype. And they got a lot of things they wanted. I don't think it was as successful as they really wanted it to be. Again, I think they have to contend with human will and ingenuity, and things don't always go totally correct for them. But they also have certain goalposts that they're trying to reach. And I think they reached some of those, and they at least established a sort of precedent for doing what they want to do. I mean, it was basically a soft rollout testing phase. And, you know, I think if you look at the AI that we have access to for free now, you can only imagine the AI they have access to. And, you know, there's a great classic rant from the first time Alex Jones was on Joe Rogan, where he's describing, you know, if you have enough information, then you can model the future. If you can model the future, then you can add stimuli to alter the course of the future. And so I genuinely think that's what they're doing. I think, I don't know if it's one AI or multiple AIs, But I think they're sort of constantly, you know, testing the waters and projecting into the future. What's going to happen here? What will people take? How far can we take this? And changing their plans in accordance with the results that they get and with what happens in real life. And I think the COVID, you will own nothing and you'll be happy. That was from an article published by the World Economic Forum. And while you're right, it's not like an official slogan. It is 100% definitely the outcome that they desire. And the interesting thing is they don't hide any of this. Like, all of this is published. Their ultimate goals are there for anybody to read. The C40 cities are a very good teaching tool. And also in the fact that this is a city-level adoption of the environmental policies that are the big Trojan horse that they're getting all of this, you know, into. Eventually, it will become, you know, they'll get rid of currency. It'll become carbon as a currency, which is life as a currency. And they're already talking about doing this at COP29, I think it was. Like, they've signed agreements to, you know, introduce this concept of replacing basically the economy as we know it with a digital record of existence. And they're talking, you know, commodifying not just humans, but animals and plants and absolutely everything. Like, all this is on the books. It's absolutely certainly happening. It's happening at the global level. It's happening at the national level. It's happening at the state level. And it's also happening at your local level. And so C40 cities are cities that the leadership has signed on to, you know, go along with these environmental programs, these Green New Deal style restrictions. And, you know, they lay out like, okay, the first phase, we're going to limit, you know, your purchasing power to this much, your travel to this much. And they say they have like five phases. And the fifth phase is like, you can take one, and I don't even get how they imagine this. It's like one-way trip, less than 500 miles on a plane per year. And you can buy four pieces of clothing per year. And nobody will own a car. Nobody will do anything. You know, nobody will own anything. Nobody will own houses. No, I mean, they publish this as their own desired outcome. So I also think it has to do with immigration. I mean, all of this is one gigantic plan, right? I mean, it really is the conspiracy. And it's about establishing a one world government. And COVID was absolutely not just a testing ground for that, but also a way to like consult. The Great Reset, I always called the Great Consolidation. The merging of business and governmental interests and powers happened at an extremely rapid rate during COVID and has only continued. So it actually established these systems, didn't just test them, but systems that are still running today, or, you know, surrendering sovereignty to the WHO. I mean, this is like a, you know, fundamental aspect of systematically and incrementally destroying national power in favor of unelected globalist self-appointed so-called leadership that has the power to censor and control and throw you in jail if they want. So, you know, all of these things are happening. The one world religion is being established, right? They came out with a new Ten Commandments that they revealed on Mount Sinai. Like, all this has actually happened. They have the House of Abraham that's supposed to be the one house for all three Abrahamic religions. So, like, all of the, and this is what they say. They're like, we are going to dissolve our differences. We all worship the same God, so let's all come together and have a one world religion. And you can see different factions of the churches. Some are going along with it, some are not. The ones that are not are under relentless attack from the same globalist powers that are, you know, orchestrating all this. So, COVID is definitely a testing ground, but it also helped them to establish some of the things that they're rolling out now. I even put out today, you know, the Kathy Hochul, the governor of New York, is talking about having a CEO hotline instead of 911. So if you're a regular plebeian like you and I, we have to call 911 and we'll probably be put on hold and maybe a cop will never come. But the CEOs, these, you know, self-appointed important people, they'll have a direct hotline to get service they need. And it reminded me of nothing more than under COVID. They had extremely strict quarantine rules, 2 weeks, you can't leave, you can't come in or out of the country, except for like if you're the leader of Google and actually in the UK, they put it explicitly. They said, unless you are an executive, in which case you don't have to obey these rules. So even in that, they were planting the idea in people's heads that like, hey, some people are just so important to the economy that will soon be based on, you know, carbon and not actual money, that these rules don't apply to them. They apply to everybody else. They're necessary for everybody else, but this is the president of Google, or this is an executive with Shell. So, you know, they don't have to obey these laws. So all of that went into COVID 100%. It was a lot of pre-programming and a lot of establishing of the Great Reset, which was
literally just the Great Consolidation. If you read their own documents, that's what they used. That's what they did, you know, under the Great Reset.
Yeah, and also market research and social research about how people respond to that must have been a big part of it. I mean, they must have got a wealth of information about what type of person is more rebellious, more obstinate, what kind of person is a problem, a troublemaker, etc., and which techniques work, which techniques piss people off, all of that. They're bound to have amassed huge amounts of data on that, which I imagine AIs are now chewing through processing.
Well, think about they tried to implement contact tracing, right? They tried to convince people that because of the virus, you had to download an app to your phone that tracked you constantly and logged everybody you interacted with. Like, what do people think? Do they think that was really for the flu, or do they think that was literally for information to do exactly what you're saying?
Yeah, yeah. I think a normie hearing this conversation and a lot of the conversations that I had during COVID, especially on Millennial, would probably think something like this. You really think that a group of people could organize all of this? That how paranoid are you to think that you're under their control? Fevered imaginings. Nobody could organize something like this. What do you think about that attitude? It seems to be the standard normie attitude when they hear stuff like this, that it's just paranoid. No one could orchestrate something like this.
Yeah, you know what's so funny is that it used to be, like, even when I started InfoWars in 2017, it sort of faded by that point. But, like, it's definitely in the 90s and the 80s, if you talked about the Bilderberg group, right, if you said, hey, or Davos, if you said all of the world elites, the, you know, industrial powers and the monarchs, and they all come together and they meet in a Swiss chateau under total cloak of silence, no reporters are allowed in or out. No, their names are not logged anywhere, and they all meet and they all plan the world agenda, and then they go back to their countries to implement it. They denied that completely. They said that doesn't happen. That's insane. You can still find articles from like the BBC going, this conspiracy theory doesn't exist and it's not happening. And then sort of people like Alex Jones, but, you know, other people sort of hammered this awareness that this is happening, and it forced them to change their tactics to where by 2017 we went to the Bilderberg meeting and they were handing out, you know, minutes going, well, here's what we'll be talking about, here's what we'll be saying. And of course all of them are coded in certain ways, right? Protecting sovereignty from Donald Trump, when really, you know, what they're doing is the exact opposite of whatever they say. But the point is that you really can't deny that this happens anymore. You can't deny that the billionaires are getting together and planning things. They're open about it. They talk about it. Davos is like a big press event now. So the crazy thing is they'll call us crazy for thinking that there are billionaires that come together to plan world domination. But how much crazier is it to know that there are billionaires getting together in secret to plan world events and thinking they're doing it because they love you? That's the funny part. And you really, really can't deny that these meetings happen, that they plan the future course of the planet. I mean, they do. By, you know, it's not even – you really can't deny it anymore. The thing that those people think is, yeah, that's happening, but it's good, and what they're doing is because they want to save the Earth from humans that are destroying it because climate change. Like, so, you know, I don't even know if that's the normie position anymore, if that's crazy, that would never happen. I think at this point, if you really make somebody – explain their thinking, I think they have to acknowledge that, yes, these types of meetings happen, this type of planning and coordination is taking place, but you think that, you know, Klaus Schwab is sincere, or Larry Fink is sincere, that he just wants a better, kinder, safer, and more, you know, verdant world. So it's very funny how much more absurd that position is than understanding that these controllers of the world, who routinely display themselves, you know, give evidence of their devious nature, are in this case doing it because, you know, they love you. And the fact that they get total control under this system is just like a happy side effect, I guess. And
It's this idea that the controllers of the world, why would you be surprised that they are controlling the world? That's what they're doing. That's what they're for. I guess it's like this idea that people with lots of power wouldn't use it. They wouldn't actually use it. Well, why would – what do you think they're – their whole point, their whole purpose is. Of course, they've amassed power in order to use it. That's the point. I think that, again, and you might be right that the normie public are less naive now than they were 4 years ago. I think you're probably right about that. But it really interested me that they had so little imagination then, that they would think, well, this is just too far-fetched. Powerful people don't actually use their power. Powerful people don't meet up and negotiate with each other and come up with plans of action. But then if you take that forward, if you actually believe that they don't do this, then, well, how does anything actually happen in the world? I mean, how is history made? How are organizations formed? How are laws dreamt up and so on? Obviously, this kind of stuff must happen and must always have happened. The difference now is that it's happening in this way that is certainly democratically illegitimate, and much worse than that, probably deeply predatory and exploitative of the general public. That's the only real difference. But the actual handling of power is something that has just always happened. I think the reason ordinary people find it so difficult to believe is that it's just so outside of their experience.
You know, but again, if you ask these same people that, you know, would be on the political other end of the spectrum from you and I, they absolutely believe in conspiracy theories, actually wilder ones than we even believe in. You know, especially, it just depends on who you're talking about. It's a weird kind of phenomenon, because if you tell them that, I don't know, all the police are hunting black people for sport, like, they believe that. They think that, you know, they understand evil happens. I don't get how people don't extrapolate out the obvious, implications of what they're seeing around them. This is what I struggle with, like, all the time on my show, covering stuff, just going, how do I even have to explain this? How is this not imminently observable to everybody else? And the thing is that the people doing this stuff are doing it in an extremely sophisticated way that has been psychologically honed into literally hacking people's brains. Like, you know, everybody knows now that, you know, the social media companies were designed specifically to give you, like, dopamine hits when you interacted with certain content. Like, that is, they might as well have a Neuralink in your head hitting the dopamine button when you do something that they like, right? They've actually hacked your brain and are, you know, unleashing and wielding chemicals in your mind to make you feel certain ways on command. Like, that's how sophisticated this stuff gets. And that's just sort of a tangible example that everybody knows. But fear is the biggest one. And when you hit people with fear, like you did with COVID, it literally on a physiological level shuts down your reasoning capability. And so people are physically incapable of reasoning through this. They revert to a primal mode of, you know, fight or flight sort of mentality, where the chemicals in their brain are, like, blocking the reason portions of their brain and are just forcing them to basically submit because they think they'll die if they don't. Like, so the way they're rolling it out is incredibly sophisticated and designed specifically to do exactly what it does. And, you know, I love, basically, I think to be a conspiracy theorist, the one thing you have to do is understand that things don't just happen. There's this mindset that things are just happening. They just occur, you know, even in the way they write about, you know, Israel invading Syria. They're just like, you know, borders have moved. And it's like, what do you mean borders have moved? Like, this doesn't make any sense. Or if you're a parent, I've seen this in, you know, friends of mine who aren't awake, their kid comes home saying that they feel like a boy when they're a girl. Or, you know, a friend who, you know, she heard a friend of her daughter calling her daughter he, and she was like, why is he calling? And she was like, oh, well, I go by boy pronouns. And, you know, to us, for people that pay attention to this, we understand, like, there's a program going on. Your child has been indoctrinated. Your child has been told propaganda that they believe. But to the parent who has no idea, they're just like, oh, my daughter thinks she's a boy. That's kind of weird. I better go – maybe I'll go talk to the school counselor. And the school counselor is sitting there trained to say, oh, this is totally normal, and your child is in the wrong body, and we have these pamphlets that can explain it to you. And so the parents are just thinking that this is just happening. So, you know, the point is that a lot of normies out there think that the rise in transgenderism is as inexplicable as the morning dew. You know, it just appears, it just arose, it just is, this is just happening. And I think as soon as you understand that things don't just happen, that things happen because people put them in motion because they want them to happen, or they try to make something happen and something else happen. Like, as long as you understand that things don't just happen and you simply ask the question, why is this happening? Who does this benefit? Where did this come from? You can just, you can unravel everything. You can start pulling the string that unravels the whole sweater. And so I think you're right that, you know, people have been seduced and distracted and, you know, programmed to just, when they see something strange, when they see something that they think is objectionable, their first reaction, and it's been pre-programmed into them, is to go, oh, I need to change to comport with the new, this new unimaginable extraterrestrial horror I'm being approached with of having a drag queen read to children in elementary school. Like, this is the type of thing that nobody should have just accepted that. Or, you know, when the Oscars comes out and says, actually, we're only awarding awards to movies that have a 50% non-white cast. Nobody should accept that. But somehow we've been indoctrinated into the idea of like, oh, I'm appalled by this. What am I? I must be wrong because everybody else thinks this is great. So I have to change myself and my own assumptions and my own beliefs to comport with whatever new horror they've unleashed on humanity. So again, once you start asking these questions, once you start looking into it, you have to extrapolate it out. You have to keep asking why. That's another thing I like saying, because I have a son that's 3 years old, and he just loves asking why. And it's a classic kid thing. Why? That's all you need to do to figure out the entirety of what's going on in the world, is just keep asking why. And when you're given an answer, ask why that answer is the answer that it is. And eventually you get to the understanding that, like, it's all on purpose, it's all by design, there is a massive global conspiracy going on, and it has been for centuries. And so that's like the red pilling process. A lot of times the black pill comes after that, because people realize how insane everything is, especially people who have been involved in some way. I always feel bad for veterans that, like, don't understand that the war that they were involved in was a total fraud until they get home, and then they, like, feel like they've betrayed people. I don't think you can – I always think back to the Hippocratic Oath. The Hippocratic Oath says, you know, doctors have to take an oath to avoid the twin traps of over-medication, over-treatment, and therapeutic nihilism. And to me, these are things that we have to avoid as well. Over-treatment is like you get so overwhelmed with how insane everything is, you just go, just screw it, just I just want somebody to come in and destroy everything. I'm just going to, you know, go out and do something crazy because I can't take it anymore. We want to avoid that. But I think therapeutic nihilism is kind of what you were explaining in the beginning, of people who sort of get – I think it has to do with ego, because I think people think that they're smarter than everyone when they're the ones that understand how doomed everything is. And all those people with hope, they just don't understand how lost everyone is. They're stupid for having hope. I think you have to push through that, and you have to first come to terms with how screwed up everything is and how long this plan is in place. But then you have to understand that, like, even though they own all of the media and all of the everything and have for decades, they still haven't won, because humanity is incredibly resilient and capable of countering the devious actions of deceitful people. So yeah, I think normie outreach is like the number one most important thing we can do. I was listening to your interview earlier, and that guy was very interesting, but and you know, obviously not everybody can be doing the same thing. So for him, he's like building, you know, he wants elite people. I think he said, like, I'm not interested in normie outreach. I that's about the only thing I'm interested in. I think we have an opportunity right now that is absolutely massive, of the awakening happening organically, and also just opening people up to the willingness to be convinced or to be shown things that they normally would have shut off completely. So I think, like, if you're not reaching out to normies with everything you've got, I think you're sort of wasting time, because we need – the normies are ready and willing to be awoken, and they just need to be pointed in the right direction, I think. So I consider that a job I like to focus on.
Yeah, I do agree. What he said was, the previous guest, was that he's not interested in his work being normie outreach. He does that in his social life. He said his friends, that's normie
outreach. That's right, yeah.
Which is fine. That's a perspective. In terms of the public being more open to these things now, I do agree. Again, with COVID, I think that really did a number on people. And during the height of it, as you said, they sort of reverted to type. Their fear does this to people. It made them just obey authority because this is a health emergency. This is a health crisis. So we've got to just do what we're told. Who are you to think that you know better than the experts kind of thing? So they were gripped by fear. And you could see that. I mean, there were, you'll have seen the same clips that I saw of people haranguing each other for not wearing the mask on public transport, this kind of thing, because they were really scared. I mean, they thought they were going to, well, they, at least in some way, they thought they could die. As it happens, I don't think that was a complete, like, I don't think that was a total belief, because if you actually thought that we're going to die, there would be mayhem. So I think to some extent it was sort of performative. They were like getting into this role, this scenario. But whatever, that's a distinction that doesn't really matter now. The point is that a lot of people were genuinely scared. And so that made them do this stuff, not see Granny when she was dying and all this. That happened, and then we're now 3-4 years on from that. And I think a lot of people have realized, even if they've not said it out loud yet, that was a load of bullshit, wasn't it? And
literally all. And that's the other crazy thing. They've admitted it now. Like, it's this is what blows my mind. And I said, because, you know, I host a 3-hour show on InfoWars every day. And, you know, half the time I'm going, look, I don't even need to be here. Like, you know, the point of being a conspiracy theorist used to be you had to, like, ferret things out. Things were hidden. You had to figure out what it was. You had to get the secret documents. You had to reveal it. Now you just, you know, you open up the front page and it's, oh, yeah, you know, the government has admitted it was probably a lab leak. Yeah, actually, they hid those, they hid that revelation. So, sorry. And then they just move on. It's like, what the hell? It's right here. So it's like, now it's like we don't have to convince people of what's going on anymore. We have to convince people to care, and that turns out to be a lot more difficult, it turns out, than just telling them what's going on. When you tell them what's going on and they go, oh, okay, and then just continue on, it's like, that's disturbing to me. So, yeah, it's all about fear. And, you know, again, when you look at it psychologically, it's not complicated. Like, none of this is really all that complicated. It gets complicated when you zoom out, but, you know, it's the fractal conspiracy. The more you zoom in and the more you zoom out, it looks exactly the same when it comes to controlling human beings. So the exact same behaviors and techniques that work to keep, you know, an abused wife with her abusive husband, it's exactly the same psychological imperatives that can control a nation. It's the same ones that control a small group like a cult of 12 people that worship their leader. It's all the exact same mechanisms at work on an individual basis or a national basis. And one of the things is that cults abuse their own members because it actually makes people more committed to the cult. And so I think when people were suffering under COVID, it actually reinforced their belief because they thought, I'm suffering this much. That's how dedicated I am. That's what makes me important. That's how I know this is real. And I think there's definitely an aspect of that where people are willing to suffer and almost subconsciously like make themselves suffer as a form of like, I don't even know what you would call it, but do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do.
It's like egotistical, I think.
It proves that they're invested.
Yeah,
but then, exactly. But then that means that they are invested, so they've got all the more reason to believe, to keep believing, because they've suffered. So it has to have been in a good cause. It has to have been genuine. Otherwise, they suffered for nothing, which is a really shitty thing to admit to.
Right. And it turns out you didn't suffer for nothing. You suffered so that the elite could enslave you all and kill your children. So it wasn't for nothing. It just wasn't for you. It was for somebody else. So, yeah. And again, I don't know how we deal with a population that can be given the truth and still not care. It has to do with just like understanding the implications of what they're telling us. Like, and part of it is, there's a weird sort of psychological forgetfulness. There's a what's the word I'm looking for? Where people just
amnesia?
Amnesia. There's almost an imposed amnesia. COVID in particular. I remember early on in COVID arguing with family members about masks and trying to make the argument of like, look, these masks are not they aren't tight enough to stop the disease coming in. It'd be like trying to stop a mosquito with a chain link fence. and trying to explain this and arguing about it and going back and forth, and, you know, nothing I said ever worked. And then literally, like, 2 years later, the same people turn to me and go, hey, you know, only N95 masks work? Yeah, it turns out the mesh of the mask is too thick. And they're telling, and I'm sitting there going, do they not remember this conversation? Like, I made this argument, and they're telling me, like, I don't know that. Like, they're telling me this. So it's, like, weird. It happens on a societal level where you go, did everybody forget that they did this to us? And in some way they did. But then it happens on a personal level, and I have no explanation for that. I don't know how that happens, but it happens in real life. You can tell people something, they ignore it, and then literally this person said to me, do you have to use N95 masks? The regular masks don't work. And I'm sitting there just like, oh, really? And they say to me, verbatim, yeah, I heard it on CNN. And it's like, oh, really? Oh, CNN, okay, thank you for telling me that. You know, and what are you supposed to say at that point? Like, I told you, I said a year ago. I don't know, man. I don't know what you do, because they have a sort of amnesia where they can't connect the dots somehow. They can't understand that, like, when they admit that it's a lab leak, what that means is that they covered up the lab leak, which means that when in the beginning of the virus, and this is whether you believe the virus or don't believe the virus.
I should just say people lost their livelihoods for saying that it was a lab leak.
Yeah, Zero Hedge got their Twitter account leaked for merely suggesting it. So, and first of all, people forget that. Like, I've had people on X go, nobody was ever, we always knew it was a lab leak. Stop being crazy. That was, everybody knew that. So again, it's like, this is Orwellian to the extreme in a way that I found hard to believe when I read 1984 for the first time. And now I'm like, oh, that's okay. Yes, you really can, you know, convince people that the sign they made was actually a plant from East Asia and they have to destroy it. Like, it's absolutely wild. It's crazy what they were able to pull off.
Well, this stuff drove me mad during COVID. This kind of thing where history would be rewritten, people would be convinced of something on flimsy grounds, and also you could see something getting signposted. This happened quite a few times, but I can't remember tangible examples to list now. But I remember this happening quite a few times. Something would be signposted, and people like us would go crazy, say, oh no, they're going to do X. And the normies would say, no, it's just a possibility that they might do it, or it's being mentioned. It's, in some scenario, they might have to do X. And then 6 months later, they do X. So it's like, it was a technique that it happened so many times that I think it must have been deliberate, where an idea would be injected into the discourse on the basis that it was never going to happen. But then that would get people used to it. That would get over the initial shock of it. Like a vaccine, I'm pretty sure that at the very start of it, they were saying there's no need for any vaccine. But that would be a very out of the ordinary for us to issue a vaccine. But then a vaccine shows up. Then they say there's only one shot. There's no way that this is going to become a long-running thing. That would be crazy. But then it does. They say two shots. Then they say it's going to be two shots plus regular boosters thereafter. I mean, we forget all of this now, but I'm pretty sure this is how it played out, where something would be done incrementally and it would be done by pre-signposting so that the shock was absorbed. It was just a hypothetical scenario.
Yep.
Shock was absorbed, then it becomes real. It's going to happen. And by that time, the public are just acquiescent.
I love that you're bringing this up, because I know exactly what you're talking about. The example I always use is vaccine passports. And there's a Vice article, I can point it to you, at the beginning of 2020, where they say vaccine passports, the latest, you know, fevered imagining of the conspiracy theorist. And I think it's even worse than you say, because those articles had the correct reaction. Because in the beginning, if you said, hey, I think they're going to use this disease to come out with the vaccine, and there's going to be vaccine passports where you're not going to be able to leave your house or travel without the vaccine passport. And people's first reaction wasn't to brush it off, say that'll never happen. It was horror. It was like, no way, that'll never. They, you know, intrinsically and immediately, their reaction is the right one of, whoa, vaccine passport, that's insane. That's crazy. That will never happen, because that's outrageous that you would even think that was going to happen. So it wasn't like they were just like brushing it off. People actually would react appropriately at first to these ideas. And then it would go through the PSYOP, where eventually they weren't just accepting that it was real, but demanding it. So, yeah, it was an incredible display of psychological control that they wielded on all of humanity immediately.
Yeah. And then, of course, another one that people have mentioned in the live chat is the thing about the vaccine. It will work first time, and it's protection, and that's it. And it will protect you against infection, against transmission, everything. Then it becomes, no, it doesn't protect you against transmission or getting infected. Thereafter it protects you somehow. But it makes you immune to it, whatever. But then it became, no, it doesn't make you immune to it. It just lessens the effect of the disease on your system.
Yep.
But then it became, it doesn't quite do that. It just protects against one strain. But as soon as another strain develops, we're going to need another vaccine. So yeah, it's going to be constant boosters.
Yeah. Well, and
when you say it now, it's just incredible that this was done. But it was done.
They finally resolved on the non-falsifiable thing, the one thing you couldn't confirm or discount, where they go, yes, I got it, but it would have been way worse. Trust me, I would be dead right now without the vaccine. It's like, well, I can't prove that one way or the other, so I guess I guess you can believe that. I don't know if you ever saw, I did a skit. I did two skits. I did the COVID pitch meeting and the vaccine pitch meeting, where I'm just sort of talking to myself, and it got hugely popular. Joe Rogan retweeted or something, and the first one had like tens of millions of views before my account got taken down. But it was hugely successful. But all I did was just act out the timeline as you just described it, where it's, you know, the one guy going, the vaccine works 100%. The other guy's like, really? And the next guy's like, no, not really. Actually, it's this. You know, and it eventually comes to, well, we don't consider you vaccinated until 2 weeks after your second dose. And even then, it only lasts a certain amount of time before you need a new dose. So it degenerated. And, it's the classic meme of like, give me my $25. I can't believe you'd keep $50 from me. That's the last time I loan you $100, right? It's 90% effective. Really? That's right. 75%. They said we'd never get to even 50%, and we almost did. And so we're working on, and it just got worse and worse and worse. And yet they're still pushing it. And yet they're still like trying to put it on the childhood vaccine schedule. And everybody acknowledges it actually makes you more likely to get the disease, and that's been proven. The more boosters you get, the more likely you are to get the disease. So we are in literally like inversion upside down stupid world, to use a politer word than the one I'm thinking.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's insane. And
there was another aspect to it that was just mental, where you couldn't have a protest that the government didn't approve of. But because that would be a super spreader event, but you could have a BLM protest, because, well, that actually helps to get the disease around so that people develop immunity.
Of course. It made people healthy. It was a miracle bestowed on us from St. George. Yeah. People were cured by going to these meetings. And that was one thing I remember, arguing with a cousin about and going, guys, because they were, all into the, we got a lockdown. It's only going to be for 2 weeks, right? And that was absurd to anybody who thought about it for a second. I remember being like, all right, if you really think this is the right thing to do, will you condemn the Black Lives Matter rallies that are bringing tens of thousands of people into a small area and just jamming them together? And, of course, they just get mad and block me and, refuse to answer, because there is no answer, because it was all absurd. It was all absurd. And you got to laugh at it a little bit, right? Like you got to maintain morale. You can't give in to the black pill. You got to just laugh at how absurd this is, while also taking it seriously, not treating it as a joke, but recognizing how hilarious all of this truly is.
Oh, yeah. I wrote a summary of this at the time, but I can't find it now. It was on my Telegram that I posted it, but I wish I could find it, because it's perfect for this. But I was basically saying that the disease and the vaccine, it was the perfect tool for them, because it could be so fine-tuned and adjusted and used in different ways depending on what they wanted. So, they could say, well, there's a new strain, so we've got to lockdown again. or they want to get people out. They want to give people something to, some freedom, some time out. So they'll say, yeah, everything's okay. The death rate's gone down, or the infection rate's gone down. Or they could say, you see, that's the thing. You do more PCR testing, well, then you get more infections because it's just detecting more infections. Because that in itself was a whole thing where the PCR test was nonsense. So you just, if you want to frighten people, you do more testing, and then you can frighten them. That's it. If you want them to relax, then you do less testing. You find fewer infections.
Yeah. Oh, and they,
unbelievable.
And they started doing, there was something else that they started doing where it was like, they openly admitted as soon as the vax came out, they were like, yeah, we're no longer, I can't remember what it was exactly. It was like, they changed the way that they counted COVID and COVID deaths. So it gave the appearance that as soon as the vax came out, hospitalizations and deaths went way down. But it was literally them just going, yeah, we're no longer, you know, relying on the – I think that's what it was. They said, well, we're no longer calling every death with a positive PCR test a COVID death. We're only going to do it to those confirmed cases that died from COVID, because obviously before that, if you crashed on a motorcycle and they tested your corpse and it tested positive for COVID, you would be declared a COVID death. And they changed that the moment the vaccine came out to give the impression that the numbers dropped drastically. So, yeah, PSYOP on PSYOP, man. Scam on top of scam. It just goes on and on. And
I've found it. I found this summary. I'll read this out to you because I'd be curious what you'd say about this. For the powers that be, COVID, the virus plus lockdown, problem plus solution, is the perfect tool to use against the public. It can be invoked, threatened, implemented, revised, expanded, revoked, reintroduced. Sometimes the analyses of the virus will make sense, but they don't need to. Sometimes the uses of the lockdown will make sense, but they don't need to. It is all entirely at the whim of the government, because the media will ratify whatever decisions it makes as perfectly justified and proportionate and completely in line with established precedent, even though there are so many contradictions along the way that there is no established precedent. A BLM rally without masks is safe. A Remembrance Day parade with masks is unsafe. You think this doesn't make sense? Well, you just don't understand science. The virus is endlessly malleable as a problem, the lockdown endlessly malleable as a solution. Never have so many been so controlled so easily. When was that? In November 2020. So it was actually before the vaccine.
And of course, the cherry on top of all of it is if anybody disagrees or points out any of these inconsistencies, you can ban them and censor them for misinformation. It's not just that they're lying, it's that they're putting people in danger. So really, it's a public health concern of why you have to be censored. Look, they're brilliant. You can't take it from them. They set up these things where it is a absolute win-win for them, and they just, you know, have incredible success sometimes. And of course, the craziest part about all of it is that they held and televised their planning session, right? Event 201. In October of that year, where they brought all these countries together and identified and did a practice scenario, and it was led by Averill Haines, who's the current DNI, had the UN, everybody was involved. And if you watch that, because they recorded it and they broadcast it, because this is the way they've altered their strategy. They used to be hidden with the proliferation of sort of easy to access mass media. They couldn't be hidden anymore. Same thing I was talking about with the Bilderberg group, right? So they transitioned. They went from we don't exist to of course we exist and we're doing it because we love you and we're the best and experts and we're sacrificing our time for this. You're welcome. So that was, the same thing they did Event 201. They publicized the whole thing because they knew they couldn't hide it. So they had to pretend that, of course, we're doing. If you watch that, their primary overriding and practically exclusive concern was about censorship, was about controlling messaging. And they justified it by saying, well, if people are saying it was a lab-created virus, then that will make people question the entire medical industry, which may make people hesitant to take the vaccine, which will make everything worse. So for the greater good and for, the world health, we have to censor the lab leak theory. That's what they're saying in Event 201, in October of 2019. And so, when you look at these planning conferences they have, they're not planning on how to identify and isolate and destroy diseases. They talk about how to use a disease to maintain and retain control over not just media, although that's the primary concern, but also over industry. And this is, you know, I don't know if you're familiar with the lockstep document, the Rockefeller planning
I've
meeting
heard
document.
Of it. I've heard of it, but you might want to describe it briefly.
Yeah, so it was a planning document from, I think, 2005, I want to say, and it was planning like 20 years in the future, and it was like Eventua One. They call it scenario planning. So all these world elite type people come together, and they play out different scenarios that might exist. And so they have – it's like a quadrant thing, and they actually grade the scenarios on adaptive capacity and something else. Anyway, one of these quadrants is called lockstep, and – they basically predicted everything that COVID was, just down to the wire, down to the nth degree. They had obviously established, you know, what the game plan was with this mysterious virus and how it would be dealt with and how all of these things would align. So, you know, they had all that stuff planned, you know, 10, 15 years in advance. I forgot why I brought that up. I'm sorry. Yeah, the lockstep. I can't remember why I was bringing up the lockstep document. Other than that, just they planned the whole thing from the very beginning. And Event 201 was just sort of, I guess, a refresher course right before they they went live with the whole thing. But
yeah, well, yeah. That I mean, the other part of this is Bill Gates. Do you see him having a particular role in COVID, or do you think he was just a profiteer essentially?
He was both. He absolutely had something to do with it. I think the best thing to do to understand Bill Gates is to go watch his interviews from like the 1990s when he's being interviewed about his takeover of software companies when he was sort of being accused of being a monopolist, because you get this sense of a guy that he just wants everything under his control, because if it's not under his control, it's unpredictable, and that is something he doesn't like. And so you get this idea, and just from that, I don't know how I came to it, but it was sort of this understanding of like, okay, they don't like humanity or nature because it's unpredictable. What they want is a society that is like it is a – oh, I just remembered, and it relates to all of this. What they want is a society that can operate like a computer chip, where you have populations that are either stable or in a constant state of continual and managed flux, which I think is the actual goal of immigration. I think there will always be immigration forever. From the third world into the first world, it'll be a constant washing machine. As the people come in, they get bastardized and denaturated, and by the third or fourth generation, they will be either castrated or, you know, incapable of sustaining life, and then they'll bring in new people. I think that's the ultimate goal here. And so what they want is the world and the human population to be basically programmable, to be able to know in exact – with extreme exactitude what's needed where. They don't want farms that have to deal with the weather. They want a big factory that produces food like any other commodity. They don't want people who might choose to go here or choose to go there. They want people on a grid that do what they're told, when they're told, or don't leave and just are, you know, on a computer headset wasting their lives on video games until they die. And so when you look at Bill Gates, even from back in the day, I think he has this thing that the globalists have, which is they don't like the unpredictability of human nature, and that's sort of what they're at war with, and that's what they fear, and that's what they're trying to gird themselves against. And this goes back to the lockstep document, because the way that they sort of grade humanity on how it's dealing with these potential projected scenarios is on this basis of like adaptability and how quickly they can change and how they can adapt. And that was the mindset that went into the way that corporations were treated differently than individuals under COVID, which I think we started talking about right earlier on. Because
yes, we did.
It's a lot. It's almost impossible to get maybe 10,000 locally owned businesses to institute a mask mandate. Practically impossible. You'll never be able to coordinate them all. If it's a corporation called Walmart and the top office just issues that memo to their to all of their outlets, they all just do it. And so in the minds of the corporatists, and I think Bill Gates is a supreme example of this, it's like that's what they want. They want everything sort of corporatized in a classic conspiracy theory pyramid structure where a very small number of people at the top or banks at the top can simply issue orders to everybody else downstream, and it all gets followed, and they don't have to worry about the local store owner's opinion. He's getting an order from corporate and he has to follow it or he gets replaced. And that's the construct that they thrive in and that they want. and all these small businesses and individuals with their individual thoughts are a barrier to their implementation of whatever they want, whenever they want, by fiat.
Yeah. And another part of this that you've just reminded me of is the, because that would be a company policy. Everyone's got to wear masks in the store. The blurring of that line between the law and mere company policy, because in the end, if you have to wear a mask in order to get your food, then it might as well be the law. It doesn't make any difference that it's just a company policy. So I think this was used because you saw it before COVID with debanking, deplatforming, censorship on, you know, the usual stuff, where a company would take it upon itself to do what the government couldn't do. It would be annoying. It would be difficult for the government to push through legislation that you have to ban someone who does X, Y, or Z. But a company, a corporation, can easily implement a policy that we're going to ban anyone who does X, Y, or Z. So in the end, you get the exact same end result, but much more easily. And of course, exceptions can always be made because it's not even the law. It's just company policy. So it doesn't, you know, there'll be this exception, that one will be reversed, whatever. It's completely arbitrary. But for the vast majority of people, it will apply just as much as a law would. So basically you get the same stuff, but with no oversight, no accountability whatsoever. And 100%. What you end up with is corporations who are controlling how you live, because, well, it works if there's no alternative for you to the corporate. You've got to go to that corporation. Then you're screwed. I mean, I remember thinking about this at one point. Like, imagine if, like, they know who I am, so I just cannot go into any Tesco. I can't use my digital ID at a Tesco. It's not going to work. But what if there is no Tesco's a supermarket over here?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, what if there's no other supermarket in my area? I'm going to starve. I mean, that. What can they do then? And I guess you could say, well, it's not the law. It's not the government doing this to you. It's just a corporation. It's your own fault for having terrible points of view, for having terrible beliefs. So, yeah, you're going to starve.
Yeah. And that's the crazy part is it's like you see all this incredibly futuristic sort of stuff that's only really possible because of the technological capabilities we have now and, you know, the way all this stuff works. And it's like, oh, okay, this is the Book of Revelations. Like, it's crazy. It is literally the mark of the beast in the Book of Revelations. And somehow it's only being fulfilled with this advanced technology, which, you know, just should really, you know, make anybody consider the importance and where this, you know, where all this stuff came from. And the term we use for it is color of law, right? It has the color of law. It looks like law. It seems like law, but it's not law. And, you know, that preys on people's, you know, desire to be liked or, as you're pointing out, just out of necessity. And this is the other thing about the globalist plan that you have to understand is they are not actually asking permission. I think a lot of people have this idea of like, well, if they try to do that, no one's going to stand for it. It's like, no, they're doing it and they're not giving you an option. They, you know, if they want you to eat bugs and not eat beef, some people will be convinced to do that. Some people won't fall for it. But if they buy up all of the cattle ranches and shut them down and slaughter the cows and stock the supermarkets that they own with bugs, what are you going to do? It's your only option, the only thing on the shelf. You're going to buy it, and then they'll make it illegal for you to have a cow, or they'll, you know, kill it with bird flu, you know, with a drone or something. And this what you hit on is I think the whole point of the Great Reset, or as we refer to it, the Great Consolidation. It is explicitly to circumvent the limitations of law, especially here in America. And obviously I have sort of an America-centric worldview, but think about if a federal agent wants to get access to your communications, they have to get a warrant. They have to go to a judge. They have to prove why you're getting it. The judge is there to guarantee your rights. If your communications are on a platform that's owned by Twitter and Twitter is really good friends with the federal government, then they just have to ask a favor. They just have to go, hey, do you mind if we have that communication? No warrant needed. So they are just straight up circumventing our God-given and you know, supposed to be government-guaranteed rights. So I think that is a huge part of why they did what they did, why they're choosing the corporate method over the you know, political one, or in conjunction, really, and you know, in cooperation with the legal one. And then it gets even crazier because look at BlackRock or Blackstone buying up family homes and renting them instead of selling them. Obviously, that's messed up for a huge number of reasons. The primary one being that you're going to pay the same or more than you would for a mortgage. You're just going to own nothing by the end of it instead of owning a house worth millions of dollars. So, you know, it's an obvious scam on that front and just a great business opportunity for the worst people in the world with all of our retirement money to make these investments. But what happens when the police want to search your house in the same way that they would need a warrant to search your communications? Well, what if your landlord is a big company that they just have to call up and go, hey, we need the keys to this guy's house. Do you mind? Or if you're, you know, if we aren't allowed to own cars anymore, because that's obviously what's happening. They're making laws to, you know, stop the production of gasoline vehicles, and we don't have the electricity production to support everybody having an electric car. So that means not everybody's going to have an electric car. Again, they're not asking you to buy an electric car. They're going to make it illegal to buy a gasoline one, and then it'll just be a fact of physics that they can't have everybody owning an electric car. And so you'll have driverless cars that are owned by nobody that you have to request permission to get access to. And do you remember during the protest on January 6th, Google Maps would not give people directions to Washington, D.C. Well, how are you going to protest the government if the transportation you need to get you there refuses to go? Like, they are setting up a system of total control. It's about circumventing your rights, but it's also about implementing just blatant control on people through corporations that we have to interact with because they're the only options available.
Absolutely. A very good example of this that I realized was there's a website, I don't know if it operates in America, there's a website for selling tickets to concerts, festivals, shows, etc. here called FestTicket. There's also another one called Ticketmaster.
That's what we have, yeah.
So that's two operating in Britain. Maybe there are others, but that's the big, that's the Pepsi and Cola. So mm-hmm. if you wanted to control this, you'd only need to, it's like we were saying earlier, you'd only need to control these two things, these two entities. And the point is that for a venue, in order to sell tickets, it really has to work with, it has to use those two platforms. So if those two platforms implement a policy, not a law, a policy, that whatever, this, everyone in the venue has to wear yellow trousers. Well, for whatever reason, then, well, you simply can't do business unless you implement that policy. Meantime, for the person who's a concert goer, he doesn't like wearing yellow trousers. Well, he's screwed because that means he cannot go to anything unless he's prepared to do that. So in this, it means that there's such centralization of control, and all without any, as I said, oversight by government or democracy or whatever. And it's all very easily done because everything is getting funneled through these bottlenecks, these nexi. So you just need to control those, and then you've got it. FestTicket, I realized if they implemented any policy, every venue would have to abide by it, and every concert goer would have to abide by it. There wouldn't be a way out. Well, there would be a way out. You just stop using, everyone agrees to stop using FestTicket. But the problem is that they won't.
Right. Well, and they have such a large market share anyway. And of course, they have, you know, other schemes simultaneously running to crush any competition from ever arising, because, you know, obviously the balancing component to that would be capitalism. It would be, okay, if this ticket company demands everybody wears yellow trousers, nobody's going to want to shop there. In an ideal sort of capitalistic, this would be a void that would open up to where anybody would go, hey, where are the ticket guys that don't make you wear yellow pants? And everybody would flood there because it would obviously, you know, be the preferable business to go to. And so, you know, if they have a monopoly or a duopoly like you're describing, that makes that, you know, more difficult or even impossible to pull off. To have competition arise naturally, there are other, you know, things like regulations and other things that crush that anyway. They also, of course, have infinite money to work with, and so any company that does arise to the point where it's competing with the big guys will almost certainly be bought out by other, you know, with using other people's money, using your money and my money, our retirement funds that are managed by BlackRock. They'll just scoop it up and pay whatever amount they need to, and then either shut it down or fold it into the, you know, pre-existing monopoly or whatever.
Well, this is why market share is the goal now. It's not profit as such.
And that's the other thing, is that on top of that, the whole incentive structure behind capitalism has been perverted entirely by ESG scores, again from BlackRock. And again, one of these things where I'm like, how did everybody just go along with this? The whole point of capitalism forever was you're supposed to get, you know, money for your shareholders. Now you're telling me that investors are investing money on companies graded by a metric that grades them higher if they do things that are guaranteed to lower their profitability, right? If, because ESG, you know, if you just hire people based on their race or sex, you're going to run a less successful company, but somehow get more investment now. So there is this, not just perverse, but like inverted structure where they're companies, and this is most obvious probably in Hollywood, like they're obviously not interested in making movies that people care about. They are not, they don't care about making a return at the box office at the end of the day because they'll be funded. They'll have cash injections of hundreds of millions of dollars whenever they want from these big financial companies that, as I keep saying, have infinite money in your pockets. So, so capitalism has been just utterly subverted and destroyed by this point, especially by things like ESG scores, which means companies can do things that would otherwise cause people to choose another company or flee them. And it won't even hurt their profits because whatever they lose in profitability, they make up for in investments because they're high up on the ESG score because whatever insane policy they implemented, you know, raises their portfolio, even though it's totally arbitrary and not based off profitability at all. So it is a deliberate undermining of capitalism that they just – that everybody just went along with somehow. Baffling, but it's true.
It really is amazing. But as I said, you only need to control a few conduits. So yep. With BlackRock, well, they create these conduits. They invest in the first place in Ticketmaster, Festicket, whatever. So then those are the only, then you've got them. And then everything else has to filter through those. So it works. So yeah, it's an amazing, and as I say, profit has fallen away, really. I think a lot of people like on the left have this view from the 80s and 90s, because when I was growing up, this was the idea that, you know, there's the archetype of the right-wing businessman, the capitalist with his money bag and his cigar, and it's all about money. But it's not, I mean, in an indirect way, it is, in the sense that money is power and power is money and all that. Money, but in another way, profit can wait. You know, profit can be delayed. It's in the first place, it's consolidating power, simplifying those, concentrating it into fewer hands so that you've got maximum control of the population. I mean, yeah, it sounds paranoid, but just look around. I mean, for God's sake, it's obvious.
And I know that this is one of my biggest frustrations with the left is like they're stuck in the 80s and 90s. It's like believing that we went to Iraq to steal their oil. It's like, do you really still – you don't understand how much bigger this thing is than just greedy people wanted the money from the oil? Like they're stuck in this like, you know, John Stewart from 2005 mindset that's like, dude, you got to move on from that. Money is important to them because it's power, because it is influential, because it's a tool to get what they want, which is control, which is power and control. And that just means people doing what you say and what you want. And yeah, it's just endlessly frustrating to me to hear, you know, when leftists are like, because it's because they just want to make money. It's like, do you not understand that they print money from nothing? They have all of the money. They have infinite money. Like, what do you mean they want all the, they want money? They press a button on a keyboard and it creates $1 trillion, literally. So they don't have to do anything to have money. They have to have money to do what they actually want to do, which is gain power. I think it's a failure of imagination. I think people can't imagine what it would be like to have infinite money. But if you imagine, especially an egotistical and evil narcissistic person who's probably the most likely to end up with all the money, if you are beyond human want, you still have an insatiable desire, and that desire is for control or for – and it's like people can't imagine what it would be like to be one of the people making decisions that reshapes the map for all of history, that, you know, launches a coup in a country, that overthrows a government of 20 million people. Like that's where – that's the level these people are operating at. And I think leftists and socialists, they're, you know, just can't imagine – people wanting more than money because that's like as far as their desires go. But if you really put yourself in the mind of like a George H.W. Bush who was running the CIA drugs into China in the, you know, 1960s and you know, helped manage everything between, you know, then and now, these people, like, see themselves as like demigods and are so far beyond money, it's laughable that people think that they're after money. It's just silly.
Well, as we said earlier, that's the limit of most people's experience of money. If you ask the ordinary average person, what would you do with $1 billion? They'll think, well, I'd buy this, I'd buy that, I'd maybe set up a nice charity. They wouldn't be thinking, I would alter society in this way. But you know, if someone is more accustomed to dealing with power and money, then that is what they think. Well, what could I do with $1 billion? I could get this done. I could get that done. I could redesign the human beings in this way. It's a completely different attitude. But yeah, I think that ordinary people are just, it just does not occur to them, partly because they're so tied to their own lives, their own everyday lives. So I'd like a bigger car. I'd get a better car with $1 billion. Yeah, sure, definitely. But partly just because lack of imagination, lack of experience. So they're just not thinking in these terms. But yeah, I think, as we said before, this is what powerful people have always done. They don't think, well, if I got a fortune, I could blow it all on a load of material rubbish. They think, well, here's what I could do with it.
And they're raised, you know, a lot of times they're raised with that because, you know, the richest, most powerful people in the world are very much parts of bloodlines that have been, you know, managing affairs for literally centuries in some cases. So, you know, they're born to this and bred to this and placed in these positions deliberately and consciously to do this. I also think that the main reason normies get things pulled over on them is they're just too nice. They're too good and they're too nice and they just cannot imagine what it's like to not be nice and good, to be a scam artist, a schemer, a devious, hateful, vengeful person, because they're not. And it in some cases it's just uncomfortable for them, but in a lot of cases I think literally impossible for them to really put themselves in those people's mindsets. I think they feel dirty even thinking that way, which they should, but you have to be able to think that way to protect yourself. Like, Sweden came out with a proposal that they were going to pay like $20,000 to Syrian migrants to go home. And like, that makes perfect sense to a Syrian person or to a Swedish person. That makes perfect sense. Oh, yes, it takes a $20,000. It's a perfect thing. We'll go on this German accent. But the same with the Germans, right? They would believe that too, right? Just, yeah, we'd take the money, we'd go home. To a Syrian person a specific Syrian person who has moved to Sweden to live off the government and is just a scam artist, gypsy type person, all they hear is, oh, they're going to pay me $20,000 to go take vacation in Syria, and when I come back home, I have to use a different name. That's their mindset, right? And so I think, like, for most people, it doesn't even enter into their mind, like, oh, I can scam this system that you're setting up. But for a lot of people in the world, that's their mindset. And if you can't image that in your own mind and project that mindset, then you're going to get screwed over and not even realize like why it's happening.
Oh, absolutely. So a system like that would only be worth doing if you could somehow make sure that the person didn't re-enter the country. Otherwise, you're clearly just setting yourself up for to be stripped of everything.
It should be obvious. I don't know why you would ever think that would work. They still have open borders. They still have infinite immigration, and they're talking about paying $20,000 to move back home. It's like you're just people are just going to be collecting $20,000 every month until you shut this program down. You fools.
How many lots of 20,000 can you get before they shut it down? Before
Seriously?
They end the gold rush? I'll get to this. Has been a lovely discussion. I've really enjoyed it. Get to some super chats. Dharma Initiate said, great talk, guys. Harrison's my favorite so far. That's great. Thank you very much. I'm glad.
Hi, Chris.
And
thank you.
There was Bluten Biden said, very good, said, take my money, Woz. Thank you very much. And Anon said, great guest. Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you. And Alt White said, you're a hero, Woz. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. And another Anon said, the government actually, and this gets an interesting thing that we haven't actually talked about yet. The government actually buys your info from these companies. You agreed to let them sell it in the TOS, the Terms of Service, so the Fourth Amendment doesn't apply. They buy it with your money, but we don't talk about that. So last year, I'm on Substack. That's where I usually make my living most of the year. And last year, I wrote an essay. There are three or four that I was really proud of. And one of them was called The Corporation and Power. Harrison, I don't know if you're familiar with the film RoboCop, the original.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, good. Sure. And I really used that as the basis for and analyzed that. And my point was that once the corporation gets you to sign a dotted line, that's kind of it. That's you giving up. The corporation is sculpting you into the client that it wants. It's getting you to sign away the rights that would otherwise be legally yours and would limit their ability to do things with you. So in the case of Murphy in RoboCop, he signed the release forms when he joined the force so that OCP, who run the police force, can do whatever they want with his dead body. He's died in the line of duty, so now his body belongs to OCP, and they can do all sorts of stuff with it, including create RoboCop out of him. So that was the idea, that what the corporation wants is to get you into a position where you will sign the dotted line, one way or another. And so what that super chat was alluding to is this that moment where you do agree to the terms of service. And one of the ways they do this is to make the terms of service so voluminous that no mortal person would ever be able to read them from beginning to end. That's one way. Another way is just legalese language that no one can understand. But another way is to just make it, well, you've got to really, because you want to be on Facebook. You've got to, because you want to be on YouTube. You've got to, because you need a PayPal account. So you've got to agree to the terms of service. Of course, technically speaking, you don't have to. You could do without PayPal. You could do without YouTube. But that's such an impediment that nobody would choose it voluntarily. So therefore, effectively, you've got to accept the terms of service. So then they've got you. They've sculpted you into the client that they require. I don't know if you'd have anything to say about that, Harrison.
I absolutely do. I'm very glad you brought this up, because I think about this quite a bit. And this might be a little bit tangential, but I think you'll see the connection, because not only are you agreeing to it, you're in a way becoming complicit to whatever they're doing. So I was thinking about this when I was watching some documentaries about the music industry, and it was talking about the way that the guy, the producer that screwed over like NSYNC and the Backstreet Boys, how he operated. And he would find these poor kids from Florida, and he would take them up to New York, and he would, you know, offer them, you could say, I'd make you a star. I'm going to make you a superstar. You're going to be traveling the world. And you just have to sign this contract. And it would be a terrible contract. And the kids, you know, the guys' mothers would be there because they were still really young guys. And the mothers would go, well, I should take this to my lawyer. And they'd go, if you walk out that door, this contract goes away and you go back into obscurity. So you either sign. And it's like, that's not illegal. It's, you know, he's not extorting them. He's offering them the world and they can choose to not accept it. But it's such a, you know, over, like, you know, the terms of service, like they kind of have to do it. I mean, he's offering them millions of dollars. So they're going to do it. But as soon as they do it and sign that dotted line, they can't sort of then go and say, oh, he screwed us over. It's like, well, but you agreed to let him screw you over. In a way, I think this kind of relates to like the idea that I always blank on the term, but it's really popular in conspiracy circles that, you know, Hollywood movies will show what they're going to do before they do it. And people think this is part of like occult programming, predictive programming.
Yeah, predictive.
And so people have this idea that it's like, well, it's an occult ritual, and to fulfill the ritual, to offload karma from themselves spiritually or in this occultish sort of ceremonial fashion, they have to do this in order for their plans to work. I think it's much more like pedestrian than that. I think if they get you to go along with it willingly, then you can't blame them or punish them or back out easily. And so I think you're exactly right when it comes to terms of service. You know, that's a subtle and sort of just blatant way. Subtle and blatant are opposites, but you know, it's not as intense as something like signing your life to a music producer so that he owns you forever and gets to pay you pennies. But in a way, it shares a similarity where if they get you to go along with it, and if they tell you what they're doing before they do it and you don't stop them or you don't interrupt them or you don't object, then in a way you have not just allowed yourself to be abused or taken advantage of. You're in a way kind of complicit with whatever that crime is, if you see what I'm saying. And I also think I was thinking about this today because what they say is, oh, well, we're just collecting your information for advertising. And I can't tell you how many times I've gotten like HIV medication ads in Spanish. And it's like, all right, so you're collecting my data 24/7 and you're giving me ads in languages I don't understand for something I will never need. So like, what are you really using that information for? I'll get advertised things that I already own in a language I don't understand at times. So it's like, all right, clearly they aren't hyper concerned with focusing ads that are going to interest me because they give me, Kamala Harris donation ads half the time. So clearly they're collecting the information for something other than commercial profit.
Yeah. Or maybe they know who you are and they're messing with you.
Teasing me. Yes, exactly. that's not a bad suggestion. I don't know if you've seen some of these HIV commercials, but if you're trying to get under my skin, they're like, it's like somebody designed it in a lab to annoy and infuriate me. So maybe there's something there.
All right. Yeah, I think there's a lot more that could be said about that. The idea of the contract, the terms of service, signing the dotted line, because then that means you can't complain. I think that's the point. After that, you can't complain. You agreed to those terms. So if BlackRock does X or Microsoft does Y, you've lost that ability, the legal rights. You've waved them away. That's the point. All right, and then HAL9000 said, read Global Coup d'etat by Dr. Jacob Nordengard, meticulously researched. It boils down to a handful of family dynasties with the Rockefellers being linchpins. All right, that's definitely something to bear in mind. Okay, well, on that note, I think that's everything. So yeah, it's been a really interesting conversation and nice, fast-paced. I've enjoyed it.
Yeah, it's been great. It's flown by, obviously. This has been super fun. I was honored to be invited. I still think it's strange because up till 2017, I was totally I didn't involve myself. And even when I got hired at InfoWars, I was just like a cameraman, editor. It's just sort of a fluke and a series of inexplicable coincidences that I'm here. And it's great because I've been a big fan of yours for a very long time. And Melanie Yule is an institution. And so I was eager to say yes when you invited me, and I've been honored to be here. Thank you so much. It's been very fun.
Well, thank you very much. I was just getting a link for that Substack essay so I can put it in the public chat. But there it is, everyone. Yeah, I've greatly enjoyed this, and it was kind of funny the way it panned out. But last year, yeah, I sometimes reach out to people in advance, but it was. Yeah, there we go. We've done it, and
great.
Regret it. It was great. I enjoyed this, and I think the people did as well. All right. Well, I will be back in about 10 minutes with the AME, the Winter Solstice AME. But in the meantime, Harrison H. Smith, thank you for appearing on Millennial X.
My pleasure. Thank you very much, and Merry Christmas.
Okay. Thank you.
On this anniversary year, a true bounty can be found in the merchandise store. T-shirts, mugs, and an incredible range of posters. All exclusive products. Every one the perfect way to remember this unique time. At the end of the festival, a very special poster will be available. But no need to wait for that. See what you can pick up today.